Our studies in the book of Daniel, which if you've read the Old Testament before coming to the school, I wouldn't be surprised if Daniel may have been one of your favorite books in the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, a lot of Christians are not that attracted to the Old Testament, but there are some books that do that either are so interesting that they become immediate favorites, or because they're so sensational. You know, Daniel and Revelation are the books of the Bible that have probably been the most sensationalized by Christians in history, I guess. Daniel being sort of an Old Testament counterpart to Revelation. And to a large extent, the subject matter of the two books overlap, as well as the imagery overlaps. But most Christians, I think, have been taught that both Daniel and Revelation give us teachings about the end of the world. And I'm not convinced that that is the case, as we shall see as we go through the prophecies and look at them, and especially as we cross-reference them to New Testament passages, which we will not do at this point because we want to have a session set aside here at the beginning for a general introduction. There's enough things that we need to say at the outset to justify an entire introductory session, and that will be this session. I've given you a handout to help make it go more quickly and save you the writer's cramp of trying to jot down everything I have to say. First of all, I want to talk about the historical background of the period in which Daniel was written. Like Ezekiel, the book of Daniel pertains to the time of the Babylonian captivity. It's very different than Ezekiel, though, in some respects, because Ezekiel and Daniel were both captives in Babylon, but Ezekiel lived among the captives in the exile community. He didn't experience any special favor, and he got to experience a slice of everyday life for a Jewish exile on a daily basis, although he had exceptional visions from God. Apart from that, the events and circumstances of his life were not much different from those of the average Jewish exile in Babylon. Daniel, on the other hand, lived in royal estate in Babylon because he was early on recognized as having special gifts, which promoted him in the government and gave him positions which were recognized. He was given lofty positions in government under four of the kings of Babylon. Now, the Babylonian exile, which provides the general time frame, we have talked about at other times. We've had many occasions to make reference to it. I might just remind you that the Jews went into Babylon in three successive deportations. There were three waves, we could say, of the conquest of Jerusalem and the deportation of its citizens. In 605 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar came, and he did very little damage, but he did take captive some of the royal seed of the Jews from Jerusalem, and he took them back to Babylon. Daniel and his three friends, whom we usually know as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, though those were not their Jewish names, they were taken at that time in that wave of deportation. It was probably not a very large number of people total that went into captivity at that time, but they were people who were the cream of Jerusalem society. Several years later, about 8 years later, in 597 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar came back and took more exiles. This time he took the king of Judah with him, who was Jehoiakim. And many exiles went into captivity with Jehoiakim. Among those were Ezekiel and his companions. So Ezekiel ended up in Babylon about 8 years or so later than Daniel did. Daniel had already been there for a while when Ezekiel got there. And then the final wave of this conquest was in 586 B.C., another 11 years later, when Zedekiah, the king that was set up, Gedaliah, the governor that the king of Babylon had, Gedaliah was set up after Zedekiah. When Zedekiah revolted against Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar came down in 586 B.C., and he destroyed the city, destroyed the temple, and took almost everybody else who was left into captivity into Babylon. And that was the end of Jerusalem for a while, until the Persians later conquered Babylon, and the first Persian king, Cyrus, gave an edict. Almost the first thing he did after conquering Babylon was to decree that the peoples who had been deported from their native lands by Nebuchadnezzar could now go back to their native lands and repatriate their own countries. And this included, in the case of the Jews, the permission to go back and rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. All of this, of course, had been predicted by Isaiah and by Jeremiah and was fulfilled in Daniel's lifetime. Daniel was one of the few guys who lived long enough to see both the beginning and the end of the Babylonian captivity. It was 605 when he was taken into captivity. It was 586, which is... It was 538 or 539 when Cyrus conquered Babylon. And so that's very close to 70 years that Daniel was there. But he was there even longer, because after the Persians conquered Babylon, Daniel served under Cyrus for the first 3 years at least of his reign. So we can say that Daniel was more than 70 years in Babylon. And we don't know how old he was when he went there, but he must have been a youth at the time. And he, in all likelihood, was over 80 years old before his story ends here. In fact, when he was in the lion's den, was very near the end of his life. It was after the Persians had conquered Babylon, and therefore it was when he was probably in his 80s that he was put in the lion's den. A lot of the pictures of Daniel in the lion's den depict him as a considerably younger man than that. It is probable that Daniel didn't go back to Jerusalem when Cyrus allowed it, because he was too old to make the trip, perhaps. His health may have been poor. Or because of the position of influence he held in the Persian government at that time, he may have felt like there was a need for him there for the sake of the Jews for some reason, or that God had put him there and he had no liberty to leave. We're not told why Daniel was not among those that returned to Jerusalem when the exile was over. There are four kings, heathen kings, under whom Daniel served. Nebuchadnezzar is the king that is in power, the Babylonian king, in chapters 1 through 4. And then in chapter 5, we have Belshazzar, who is the last of the Babylonian kings. He was in power when Babylon fell to the Persians. Then in Belshazzar is also mentioned in chapters 7 and 8. This is not necessarily in chronological order the chapters are arranged. We see the fall of Babylon and the death of Belshazzar in chapter 5. But in chapters 7 and 8, those chapters were also written during the reign of Belshazzar. Then there were two Persian kings, or two Persian names at least, Darius the Mede, who is not known to us from history outside of the book of Daniel. He is mentioned in chapters 6 and 9 and 11. He is the ruler in those chapters, during which time Daniel wrote those chapters, chapters 6, 9, and 11. And then Cyrus, the Persian conqueror, who is mentioned in chapter 10. So there are four pagan rulers under whom Daniel served, and he was honored by all of them, it would appear. Now, in Daniel's own life, there had been some godly influence, it would appear, since Daniel chapter 1 tells us that Daniel was among those who were of the king's descendants, or the nobles, we don't know which, in Daniel 1:3. He was apparently close to the royal family, if not part of it. And his birth must have occurred sometime around the time of Josiah's reforms, because if he was a youth at the time in 605 B.C., then that he was taken away, a youth, we would assume, he must, in all likelihood, was in his teens, possibly his early teens. But if that is true, that would mean that he had been born right around the time of the reforms of Josiah. And if he was of royal blood or otherwise close to the royal family, he may have been influenced by Josiah's reforms, maybe even more than the average citizen was. We know that Daniel was familiar with Jeremiah, whose prophecies began in Jerusalem around the time of Josiah's reform, and Daniel living in Jerusalem and Jeremiah publicly preaching there. It is unlikely that Daniel would have been unaware of Jeremiah. In fact, he knows Jeremiah's book, because in Daniel chapter 9, and verse 2, we read that Daniel was reading in Babylon. He was reading the book of Jeremiah. And so he was aware of Jeremiah's book, at least. In all likelihood, he had heard him personally in his childhood before he was taken away into Babylon. So Josiah's reforms and the ministry of Jeremiah probably had some effect on establishing the godly convictions that we see that he had even as a youth. We don't know whether Daniel knew Ezekiel or not. As I said, they were both in Babylon at the same time, but not in the city of Babylon. Daniel was apparently in the city of Babylon in the early days, but Ezekiel was not in the city of Babylon. He was just in the regions controlled by Babylon, and Daniel may never have met him, although he may have. Ezekiel certainly knew about Daniel and mentions him three times in his book, in Ezekiel chapter 14. And I might turn your attention there because just to point out to you, there is a bit of controversy, but I don't think it's of any value or of any weight as to whether Ezekiel is really talking about Daniel here. But in Ezekiel 14 and verse 14, God says to Ezekiel, though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, meaning in Jerusalem, they would deliver only themselves by their righteousness, says the Lord God. Then in the same chapter, verse 20, it says, even though Noah, Daniel, and Job were in it, as I live, says the Lord God, they would deliver neither son nor daughter, they would deliver only themselves by their righteousness. Now, here there are three men mentioned. Two of them, we know for sure who they were, Noah and Job. And Daniel, there doesn't seem to be any reason to doubt who Daniel was. However, some critics have said, well, would Daniel really be that well known? That God would mention him to Ezekiel as someone of equal stature as Noah and Job? I mean, Noah and Job were great heroes from hundreds of years earlier. Would a living Jewish man be linked with them as being so unusually outstanding? Well, I mean, the question is asked, and they imply a negative answer, but I don't see any reason to imply a negative answer. Daniel was famous in Babylon. And by the time Ezekiel wrote these words, I think Daniel had been there about 12 years. He may well have been known throughout the entire empire. He was the wisest man in Babylon, so recognized. And there's not any reason why Ezekiel could not have been aware of him. In the Hebrew text, however, the word Daniel here is spelled a little bit differently in Ezekiel than it is in the book of Daniel. And so some scholars have said, well, this was not really talking about Daniel the prophet. It was talking about a Ugaritic hero known to the Babylonians named Daniel. And they say the pronunciation or the spelling is different and should be rendered here Daniel instead of Daniel. And that he's talking about some maybe mythical or legendary hero known to the Babylonians. Now, this sounds just like the kind of thing liberals would come up with. I mean, that's a totally absurd suggestion. Because if it seems unlikely that a living prophet would be listed with Noah and Job to these critics, and that's one reason for arguing that Daniel probably isn't referred to in Ezekiel 14, then it's even less likely that some Ugaritic legendary hero, not even a Jew, not even a man of Jehovah, would be listed along with Noah and Job as, you know, chief in righteousness. You know, I mean, it's much more likely that Daniel, Ezekiel's contemporary in Babylon, was the one referred to there, and I don't see any serious reason to doubt it. In Ezekiel 28 also, when speaking to the king of Tyre and rebuking him for his arrogance and speaking rather sarcastically, Ezekiel says in Ezekiel 28 verse 3, behold, you are wiser than Daniel. There is no secret that can be hidden from you. Once again, the critics would say, well, this is Daniel, the Ugaritic hero, but Daniel, the prophet, is much more likely to be the one mentioned here. After all, it says no secret can be hidden from you. Daniel proved that no secret could be hidden from him if God wished to reveal it, because the Chaldeans were unable to tell Nebuchadnezzar what his dream was, and Daniel was able to reveal it. And Daniel had a reputation of being one from whom nothing could be hidden. So it seems obvious that the reference in Ezekiel 28:3 is to our prophet Daniel here. And there's no reason to go along with the critics who are always looking for reasons to discredit. Now, you might say, well, why would the critics have any stake in this? Why would they want to discredit the idea that Ezekiel is referring to the man Daniel? Well, we'll find a little later on in this introduction that critics who do not believe in the supernatural have a great deal of difficulty with the book of Daniel. And therefore, it is very common for them to say Daniel never really existed in the days of Nebuchadnezzar. But the book was written as a fiction centuries after the alleged time, sometime maybe in the Maccabean period in the early 2nd century B.C., hundreds of years after the alleged time of Daniel. And, of course, if they were If their theory were correct, then Ezekiel couldn't possibly know Daniel, because Ezekiel would have not. I mean, Daniel didn't exist, and his book didn't even exist for hundreds of years later. So to have Ezekiel making reference to Daniel like that, if he is referring to Daniel, proves that, in fact, Daniel was a historical character contemporary with Ezekiel, known to Ezekiel, and it gives much weight to the historical setting of the book of Daniel, which the book claims for itself, but which critics want to deny. Just a little bit of bio about Daniel, and some of these points we've already made. He was born, apparently, of the king's family or nobility. We get this from Daniel 1:3, which says, "The king, that is Nebuchadnezzar, instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles, young men in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace." And he brought them and he instructed him, Daniel was one of these young men, in the Chaldean language for 3 years. He received special training so that he could serve the king of Babylon. He was chosen partly for his good looks, his lack of blemishes, and for his native wisdom and so forth. And he apparently, in addition to his inspired revelations, had a good bit of native wit that was recognized early on. Like Joseph, however, who was exiled in Egypt, Daniel in Babylon received special notoriety because of supernatural revelations that were made to him in the captivity. God gave both Joseph and Daniel recognition in the sight of the kings under whom they were exiles by giving them the ability to interpret dreams when the pagan wise men were unable to do so. Pharaoh, you remember, had two dreams. The wise men couldn't tell him the dreams, and therefore Joseph had to be brought in to tell Pharaoh what his dreams meant. Nebuchadnezzar had a dream in chapter 2, and no wise man could understand it. None of the Chaldeans or astrologers could understand it, and so Daniel came and gave the interpretation. And in both cases, Joseph, in his case, was elevated from prison to practically the throne in one day because of his ability to interpret the Pharaoh's dreams, and Daniel arose from not total obscurity, but relative obscurity, to great fame and prestige in Babylon by the same means, by interpreting Nebuchadnezzar's dream in chapter 2. Daniel served as a statesman mostly. The Jews don't even include the book of Daniel among the prophets. They put Daniel in another section of their scriptures called the writings, which include the Psalms and the Proverbs and some of those things. And probably the reason that they don't include Daniel among the prophets is he never really filled the office of a prophet. Generally speaking, Jewish prophets were God's spokesmen to the Jewish people, sort of the mediators between God and his covenant people. Daniel never served in a role like that. Actually, all of Daniel's prophecies related to Gentile powers. And as far as we know, he never prophesied to the Jews about their relationship with God or anything like that. Rather, he predicted future things. He saw dreams and visions that were prophetic, in fact, but he never really occupied the office of prophet. He was more a political figure. He was a statesman. We don't know much of his activities except where his stand for righteousness was in conflict with his civic duties. We read stories about that, but we don't know much of how he functioned day by day in the government. But he did serve under the kings of Babylon and under the kings of Persia until at least the third year of Cyrus, which was 536 B.C. And that's the last known date in the book of Daniel. He may have lived for some time after that date, but we don't read of anything after that. In addition to being a statesman, though, he really is rightly referred to as a prophet. It says in Numbers chapter 12 and verse 6, and God is here speaking to rebuke Miriam and Aaron for their rising up in rebellion against Moses. But God said in Numbers 12 and verse 6, "Hear now my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision, and I speak to him in a dream." Then he goes on to say, "Not so with my servant Moses." He gets plainer revelations than that. But if God says, if I raise up a prophet, I'll reveal myself to him in visions and dreams, certainly that makes Daniel one of them. Daniel received visions, and he received dreams and interpretations of dreams. And that clearly puts him within the category that God himself defined as a prophet raised up among the people. Also, I mean, if that wasn't enough, Jesus himself referred to Daniel as a prophet. In Matthew 24 and verse 15, as well as in the parallels in Mark and Luke, in what's called the Olivet Discourse. In Matthew 24, verse 15, Jesus said, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, spoken of by Daniel, the prophet, standing in the holy place." So, Jesus refers to Daniel as a prophet. All right, so Daniel was both a statesman and a prophet. Principally as a vocation, he served as a statesman, but because he received prophetic insights and revelations, he also rightly is called a prophet, and there's no reason why we shouldn't include him, as our Bible does, among the prophets. The Jews have another arrangement of their books. Now, I want to talk to you about Daniel in the critics' den. The critics, meaning liberal critics of the past century, approximately, who have tried to debunk the book of Daniel and discredit it every way they can. The expression Daniel in the critics' den is not original. There's at least two different books with that title, one by Josh McDowell and one by, I think it's by Sir Robert Anderson, but I'm not sure. In any case, Daniel has come under more criticism from liberal scholarship than most other books of the Old Testament. And there's a very good reason for it. There's probably three books in the Old Testament that are the most damaging to the thesis of liberal scholarship. The thesis being, nature is all there is. Or if God exists, he exists without intervening supernaturally in the natural world. According to virtually all liberal orthodoxy, there are no miracles. There is no supernatural. God does not act supernaturally. If God exists at all, and some liberals in biblical scholarship don't believe he does, but if God does exist at all, he's not really dirtied his hands with the affairs of earth much. He may be aware of what's going on, but he never gets involved. That is the basic premise from which all scholars work. Someone was asking me today about William Barclay's commentaries. I didn't give a long answer, but William Barclay's commentaries are very scholarly, very insightful in many ways. However, he is tinged a bit with this very liberal idea. He hedges on the question of the resurrection of Jesus. He explains away many of the miracles of Jesus in naturalistic ways, because being in some ways a product of the religious environment where he served in England in the early part of this century, he was somewhat either influenced by or else intimidated by liberal scholarship. And so it just, you'll find that while he's got some very, very edifying and helpful things to say, and he seemed to really love the Lord, he just is really weak on the subject of the miracles. Now he's considered an evangelical scholar. He's not considered a liberal. But if you go further into liberal scholarship, they don't hedge. They just deny outright that any miracles occur. But one of the miracles that they deny occurs is that of predictive prophecy. That is where someone actually gets a revelation from God about something that's going to happen. How could that happen? That would be supernatural. And they don't believe supernatural things happen. I said there are three Old Testament books, probably more than any other, that are really the battleground between evangelical Christianity and liberalism. One would be Genesis. And Genesis would be simply because it attributes supernatural creation, a supernatural flood, and so forth. And critics just can't live with those ideas. They might not have so much trouble with everything after Genesis 12, where you get into family history of Abraham and his descendants, but the first 11 chapters of Genesis, with the Tower of Babel and the flood and the creation story and the fall and so forth, they just can't stomach that. It's just too supernatural. Everything about it's supernatural throughout. And so, although they don't try to debunk, I take that back. I was going to say they don't try to debunk the authorship of Genesis. They certainly do. They have their own theories about the authorship. But their main thing they do is just deny its historicity. They deny that it's historical. But the other two books in the Old Testament that really give problems to liberals are Isaiah and Daniel. And Isaiah and Daniel have come under attack because of their very clear and specific prophecies that they made, in many cases hundreds of years before their fulfillment. We have seen already that Isaiah, in chapters 44 and 45, specified the name of the Persian conqueror of Babylon as Cyrus. Actually named him and called him by name several times in Isaiah 44 and 45. And yet Isaiah lived 150 years before Cyrus was born. Therefore, we either have a very genuine and remarkable and indisputable case of supernatural revelation in Isaiah there, or else we have a forgery, a fraud. And, of course, the liberal scholarship always tries to say, well, those parts of Isaiah were written later by someone after the fact. Why do they say that? Not that there's any good evidence. We studied in our introduction to Isaiah that the idea that more than one author wrote Isaiah and that it was late dated is not supportable by any objective evidence, and there's much internal evidence that it's all one author. In fact, Jesus and the apostles quoted from all parts of Isaiah and attributed them to the same man. So it's the liberal scholars against Jesus and against the Jews and against the internal evidence. But why do they say this? For only one reason. Because to them it's inconceivable that a man living in Isaiah's day, in the reign of Hezekiah, could possibly have named Cyrus, who didn't come onto the scene until 150 years or 200 years later. And so Isaiah is a real bone in the throat of the liberal scholars. And another one, maybe even worse, is Daniel. Many scholars have pointed out that the book of Daniel is the prime battleground between those who do and those who do not believe in supernatural inspiration. Because Daniel does far more even than Isaiah does. Although Daniel doesn't really give the names of the person he describes their actions hundreds of years in advance in many cases, so specifically that it'd be very hard to miss his meaning. In fact, this is why liberal scholars attribute Daniel to a date much later than the actual date of writing. And it is because he actually gives very specific reference to the actions of Alexander the Great, of what would happen after Alexander the Great would die, of the rise of Antiochus Epiphanes and his desecration of the temple in 168 B.C. I mean, very specific. No one can miss it. Even the liberals can't miss it. They know that those passages have got to be talking about those historic events. But they can't believe anyone would be able to be so specific about such things unless they wrote after the events themselves. And so for almost entirely arbitrary reasons, they simply post-date, they late-date the book of Daniel and say, well, it must have been written during the Maccabean period after Antiochus Epiphanes had arisen because there's such specific reference to what Antiochus Epiphanes did. And this is how they argue it. Now, of course, to late date the book of Daniel, which professes to be written by Daniel, a man living in the time of Nebuchadnezzar and so forth, and to just arbitrarily put it several hundred years later than its professed date, would seem a bit biased, would seem to be a little bit dishonest, unless there were some evidences that could be brought forward to prove that Daniel was not written, in fact, in the days where it purports to be written. And so scholars from the time of Porphyry on, back a few hundred years after Christ, I think it was the 3rd or 4th century after Christ, the first critic of Daniel wrote a treatise against the Christians. And one of his volumes was dedicated to debunking Daniel. And most of the things that Porphyry wrote in his rebuttal of Daniel about the 4th century have been repeated again and again, sometimes with a little bit higher degree of sophistication on their side, by critical scholars ever since. However, all their arguments are weak and invalid. And really, once you see how weak and invalid their arguments are, you begin to wonder, well, what is their real reason for making this claim? And of course, their real reason is simply this. They cannot allow themselves to believe in a God who reveals things supernaturally to people. They can't allow themselves to believe in a God who's that near and involved in human history. Why? Because they're committed to naturalism. And they don't believe in supernaturalism. So it is really their philosophical bigotry and not objective consideration of evidences that leads them to the conclusion that Daniel was written later. Let me go through some of the arguments that have been brought by the critics trying to prove that Daniel was not written at the early date that it professes to be written. And by the early date, we're talking about, you know, some of those early things in Daniel happened around 602 B.C., 600 years before Christ. But Antiochus Epiphanes was not even 200 years before Christ. So there's like a 400-year gap from the time that Daniel began writing and the time that some of the things that he predicted took place. Of course, and even more, because he predicted the coming of the Messiah. And he gave the specific year that the Messiah would show up in Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 through 27. we have the famous prophecy of the 70 weeks, and he actually gives the year at which the Messiah can be expected to show. And Jesus came that year. And obviously, even if you could late date Daniel to the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, 168 years before Christ, you'd have to do some real quick fancy footwork to try to prove that it was written after the time of Jesus, since Jesus referred to Daniel the prophet as a known entity already among the Jews, and Josephus knew about Daniel as a historical character. It simply can't be done. If a person wants to try to post-date Daniel to a time later than all the fulfillments of the things he predicted, they're going to get themselves into serious trouble, because, as I say, he actually predicts the coming of the Messiah, and Jesus came at the time he predicted. We'll see that, of course, sometime later in our studies. Let me give you some of the arguments that the critics have used. Many of these you will never encounter unless you are involved in the realm of apologetics or teaching. There are times, however, even just witnessing to someone on the street, you might meet a well-read atheist or someone who might have some arguments against the book of Daniel. If you do, these are the arguments they'll bring. And it wouldn't hurt you to know what the arguments are and how they're to be answered. First argument, I'm going to first of all give you what the critics' arguments are, one by one, without refuting them. And then I'm going to go back and tell you what can be said to each of these arguments. First of all, it is said that the manuscript of Daniel contains a great number of Persian and Greek loan words. Now, Daniel is one of the few books in the Old Testament that's written in two languages. Half the chapters are written in Hebrew and half in Aramaic. Aramaic, like all languages, has words that it has borrowed from other languages. I mean, in English, we have French and Latin and German loan words. We have loan words from Spanish. I mean, words that have just become part of our vocabulary, but they originated in another language, which, of course, makes it clear that modern English has grown through a contact with these other languages and has taken in some of the vocabulary. Well, every language has its loan words, which means they borrowed from other languages. In Daniel, the Aramaic and Hebrew portions actually contain, it is argued, a number of words that could be seen to be Persian loanwords and Greek loanwords. Now, if it was merely Persian loanwords, it wouldn't be a problem. Daniel lived at the beginning of the Persian period. When the Persians conquered Babylon, he was there. On the other hand, the Greeks didn't come along and conquer the world until another almost 300 years after Daniel's time. Well, after early Daniel's time, I'd say from the late Daniel's time, probably closer to 200 years later, the Greeks came along. Alexander the Great conquered the world and made a Greek empire. And it is thought that the Greek loanwords in Daniel must have entered the language at a time much later than the time of Nebuchadnezzar and the time of Daniel's actual living. However, many studies have been done. Well, we won't go into this right now, but studies have been done to show that that's a weak argument, because there were Greek loanwords in even earlier literature than this. The Greek language existed before the time of Alexander the Great, and these people did have contact with Greek people so much that Greek loanwords did exist both in Hebrew and Aramaic long time before the time of Greek control of the world. Anyway, I said I wasn't going to refute these until I got through them all. Number two, I've mentioned earlier that the Masoretic Canon, which was put together by the Jews in the 6th or 7th century A.D., does not include Daniel among the prophets, but includes Daniel among the writings instead. The critics say, well, that shows that the Jews apparently didn't consider Daniel to be a genuine prophet, more like a book of wisdom literature like Ecclesiastes or Proverbs or something like that, but not a prophet. And this is supposed to prove that Daniel, in fact, was not a prophet, because the Jews who put together the Masoretic Canon in the 6th or 7th century A.D. didn't include him there. However, Jesus, in the 1st century A.D., said Daniel, the prophet. And because of that, we know that whether the Jews regarded Daniel to be a prophet or not, and of course they did, but he didn't hold the office of a theocratic mediator between God and the nation Israel, which is probably the reason the Jews didn't put him with the prophets in their canon in the 6th and 7th centuries. But Daniel was known to be a prophet by the Jews, by Jesus, back in the 1st century, long before the Masoretic Canon came into existence. So this argument doesn't work. Again, I'm doing what I said I wouldn't do. I'm refuting the arguments rather than just telling you what they are. Okay, here, maybe I can hold off on the rebuttals of these ones. The rest of the arguments against it are where the book of Daniel is alleged to be filled with historical inaccuracies. The book of Daniel actually is half the book is historical information, and half is prophetic. But if the book is historically inaccurate, it suggests not only that it isn't inspired, but it was probably not written at a time near the dates that it seems to be claiming to be written. Because it was thought that people who lived at the time Daniel claims to have lived would know the history and would know the chief persons and their positions and so forth. And it is claimed, or has been claimed over the years, that Daniel was written by somebody who was mistaken about a lot of the history of the period of Babylon. Let me give you some of the examples that have been brought up. It says in Daniel chapter 1 and verse 1, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Now, one problem here is that it refers to Nebuchadnezzar as the king of Babylon in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim and of the siege of Jerusalem. Yet, Nebuchadnezzar, it is said, was not actually king yet. He was still making his conquest under his father Nabopolassar, and he became king afterwards. And furthermore, this reference to the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim seems to be in conflict even with the Bible itself. In Jeremiah chapter 25, there is thought to be a contradiction here. In Jeremiah chapter 25, verse 1, it says, the word that came to Jeremiah concerning all the people of Judah in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, which was the first year of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. Now, the problem here is that both Daniel and Jeremiah speak of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. However, Jeremiah says that the first year of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, was the fourth year of Jehoiakim. But Daniel speaks of the third year of Jehoiakim being a time where King Nebuchadnezzar came and besieged Jerusalem. So we've got what looks like a conflict. Is it the third year of Jehoiakim or the fourth year of Jehoiakim that Nebuchadnezzar besieged Jerusalem? That is thought to be a historical inaccuracy and even a contradiction within Scripture. We'll address that in a moment. Another historical alleged inaccuracy is that it is said that the book of Daniel uses the word Chaldeans inaccurately. The Chaldeans are known now to have been a race of people, an ethnic designation, generally referring to a dominant race in the Babylonian Empire. But it is argued that the book of Daniel knows only of the Chaldeans as a class of priests or wise men or soothsayers, and not as an ethnic designation. And therefore, it is thought that the writer of the book of Daniel lived a long time after the Chaldean period, and the word Chaldean had lost its now known meaning, and the author had the wrong idea of who Chaldeans were. He thought they were just soothsayers and so forth. There are places in Daniel that speaks of the Chaldeans in a way like that. In Daniel chapter 2, the Chaldeans are consulted by Nebuchadnezzar to tell him his dream and interpret it, and they cannot. Also, excuse me, in chapter 4 and verse 7, it says, then the magicians, the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers came in, and I told them the dream. That's Nebuchadnezzar speaking there. Again, the soothsayers listed with the astrologers and wise men and so forth. Also in chapter 5, verse 7, and again in the same chapter, verse 11, it says, the king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. Also in verse 11. Where they're spoken of the same way, along with the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. So it is thought that the word Chaldeans in Daniel is used in a way that restricts it to sort of a vocation rather than a race. Rather than an ethnic designation, it speaks of a caste of sort of prophet priests or fortune-telling priests. And therefore, the book gives evidence of not really knowing what Chaldeans were, or what the word means, and therefore must not have been written anywhere near the period where the Chaldeans reigned. Another argument is that in chapter 4 of Daniel, we read of Nebuchadnezzar going mad for a period of time. Now, in the actual chapter, it says that he would eat grass like an ox until 7 times passed over him. It's not clear whether 7 times means 7 years, as many think, or 7 seasons. The Babylonians knew 2 seasons, the hot and the cold season. And so seven seasons would be 3.5 years. The Bible doesn't specify the exact number of years that Nebuchadnezzar was in this condition. The actual madness that he had is, there's a name for it. There are some rare cases of it known in history. It's called boanthropy, where a man acts like a cow. Bo is from bovine, like cow, and anthropy from anthropos, man. But boanthropy is an actual, you know, they call it a mental illness or a mental derangement that some people have, and so it seems rather correct to describe Nebuchadnezzar's illness that way, or the plague or the curse that came upon him. It is argued, I have here, for example, a quote from a critic, his name is Cartledge, who said, "History knows nothing of the madness of Nebuchadnezzar reported in Daniel." Now, in view of the fact that an awful lot is said about Nebuchadnezzar in the old Greek historians, Herodotus, Xenophon, and some others, and from other sources, Nebuchadnezzar is fairly well known, it would seem strange that something as remarkable as his becoming insane for 3.5 or 7 years would go unmentioned in the records, and is thought that shows that the story is probably made up and is a fiction, has nothing to do with reality. Another argument that's brought is about Belshazzar the king. In chapter 5 of Daniel, it is clear that when Babylon fell to the Medes and the Persians, Belshazzar was the king reigning there, according to Daniel chapter 5. It's Belshazzar who saw the writing on the wall. And he couldn't interpret it, and his soothsayers and so forth couldn't interpret it either. And Daniel finally came in, and Belshazzar said, "If you can interpret this for me, I'll make you third ruler in the kingdom." And Daniel said, "Keep your rewards to yourself, but I'll read it for you." And he announced that the Medes and the Persians had broken into the city, and were going to conquer it that night. And in fact, Belshazzar died that night. Which makes it clear that Belshazzar was the king, the last king, ruling in Babylon at the time that it fell to the Medes and Persians. However, there's some problems with that, because Herodotus, who was a Greek historian writing 400 years before Christ, and Xenophon and Berosus, and Abidinus, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, I think it's Abidinus, as well as the contemporary cuneiform writings, mentioned the last king of Babylon at the time of his fall being Nabonidus, not Belshazzar. And for a very long time it was thought that the book of Daniel must have just made up the name Belshazzar. It wasn't found in history records of the Greeks or whatever, even the ones who lived not so long after the time of its fall. I mean, it fell in 539 B.C. Babylon fell to the Persians, and Herodotus wrote 160 years later. How could he be wrong? How could Herodotus think that Nabonidus was the king if, in fact, a man named Belshazzar was at the time of his fall? So it was assumed that Daniel must be wrong. Daniel must have been written at a much later date and by someone who was not very familiar with the actual history of the fall of Babylon, and who got it wrong, who either made up a name or just mistakenly thought that the name of the ruling king of Babylon at the time of his fall was Belshazzar. And that was considered to be a major historical blunder in the book of Daniel, and obviously a proof of its non-inspiration, and it's not even very accurate in its history. A fifth historical argument that's been brought against the book of Daniel is that it mentions repeatedly somebody named Darius the Mede. There is no known person in history known as Darius the Mede. The way that the book of Daniel speaks about Darius in chapters 8 and 9 and 11 gives the profound impression that he was the one who conquered Babylon. In fact, I think he's mentioned at the end of chapter 5 also. Let me see here. Yeah. In chapter 5, verse 30 and 31, it says, "That very night Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Now, this is